Fed up with awkward customer conversations over who is responsible for damaged equipment? What if there was a way to prove this without a debate? With Record 360, you get time-stamped, geo-tagged photo and video proof. For total protection and complete peace of mind, visit record360.com/UK to learn more.
It's Wednesday, the 1st of April, 2026, and this is Reconstruction from the Construction Index with Phil Bishop and David Taylor. No, it really is, even though it's the 1st of April, it really is Reconstruction. Although, due to scheduling changes and technical issues, it might turn into a bit of an April Fool's joke, but we'll see how we get on. So anyway, Phil, how are you doing today?
All right. I mean, the first thing we're going to talk about is a topic that I've just noticed was also something we spoke about in our very, very first podcast, all the way back January 2020. Late payment legislation. We're talking about it back then. We could have been talking about it in 2014 if we'd had a podcast then as well. So it's one of those subjects that just doesn't go away. And we're going to be talking also about different types of fuel, I suppose. We'll in different ways we'll be talking about. But no, I'm doing quite well. How are you doing this morning, David?
I'm doing all right. I'm a bit frazzled because I've been out and about unexpectedly and had to race back in order to be here for the podcast. So I'm all over the place at the moment. But apart from that, I'm safe. I'm at home, so we should be okay.
Good. Right. Well, let's crack on. I mentioned that in our very first issue, more than 6 years ago now, we talked about late payment legislation, and that's been in the news again. Last week, the government published proposals for the toughest laws on late payment in the G7. I think they probably said toughest laws on late payment in a generation as well. Crackdown on late payments in over 25 years. It's not, it's in more than 25 years. It's over a fence and more than 25 years. But we'll let that slide. This crackdown is much the same. It's just more of the same. Harsher penalties for people who don't pay their invoices in the allotted time. What is particularly interesting, significant for the construction industry, is that they're talking about banning retention payments again. Now, we had Rudy Klein on last month, didn't we, Dave, talking about this whole topic. And he was saying, when are they going to get on with this? Well, you could say they're now getting on with it. Or are they? Actually, what they're doing is having another bloody consultation.
Well, this is it, yeah. I mean, as you say, it's the gift that keeps on giving, late payment, because it keeps the lawyers happy and all the trade associations are always exercised about it. What used to be called subby abuse when I was working on the weekly magazines, it was basically main contractors not paying their subcontractors on time, withholding retentions, and in many cases actually withholding money deliberately in order to see the subcontractor go bust so they don't have to pay them at all. And of course, it's been a big bone of contention in the industry for many, many years. But now they're actually talking about banning retentions. And I was quite surprised to read about this, because I know that although retentions almost is a dirty word, especially amongst suppliers and people in the supply chain, there are legitimate reasons to withhold retentions from a contract. You know, if a contractor, a subcontractor, does a shoddy job and then walk away with full payment, then of course the main contractor is out of pocket and has to remedy the situation somehow. So there are arguments for and against banning retentions, but I think probably the balance is for banning them. Most people want to see them got rid of because they've been such a problem over the years.
The trouble is, people who want rid of them are the people with the little voice, and it's the people with the big voice who want to keep them.
Yes, of course.
Yeah. And for all that the Labour is, supposedly the party of the little man, the little person, ain't necessarily so. So yeah. I think we'll be back here again in another, 2 years, 4 years, 6 years, because, as you say, it just keeps coming around. So another consultation, let's see what happens with that, moving swiftly on to my favourite government press release of last week. Ministers rip up consultation culture. They say they're ministers working closely with the new cabinet secretary have ordered a clear-up of Whitehall consultation culture to speed up decision-making and deliver for the British people. End the introduction of unnecessary consultations that we're having all the time. Mm. And they put this out on the very same day as they announced a raft of consultations.
Yes, including this one about late payment, of course.
Yes. I mean, it's only a slight pity that they had enough awareness not to have a consultation on whether they should clamp down on consultations or not. They said they're just going to do it. We're not going to ask your opinion. We don't want to know what you think. We're just going to cut down on consultations. Meanwhile, all these other government departments are printing consultation papers. And these are things we've been talking about for, again, more than 6 years, 9 years in more this case. The Ministry of Housing loves nothing more than a consultation, all the building regs stuff.
Yeah.
It's currently got, Ministry of Housing, Communities and Local Government has currently got 15 live consultations. It's asking, you know, stakeholders, vested interests, the general public and everyone what they think of X, Y and Z. And some of them are really quite gricey. And think, why don't you just get on with it?
For
example, they want to know, latest consultation for the Ministry of Housing, what do you think of plans to redefine Category A to exclude work undertaken entirely within flats unless it affects wider building safety systems, and to exclude small-scale, low-complexity works in communal areas from Category A, allowing them to be managed via the easier Category B pathway? And you think, just do it. What has it been? 9 years since that fire exposed all the shortcomings. We've had inquiry after inquiry. We've had the official inquiry. You've had reports done. Everyone's told you what's gone wrong. Everyone tells you what needs to be done. Just do it.
Yeah, but there's nothing people...
Or don't do it more. And leave us alone.
Well, possibly. But there's nothing that people resent more, really, than the government doing something over their heads without consulting them. I mean, it's democracy, isn't it? That, you know, they have to get our permission. We elect them. We expect them to do the job. But they've got to ask our permission to do certain things. They want to know that they're doing the right thing. You know, I'm not surprised that they're always issuing these consultations. But I think probably this announcement that they're going to sort of cut through all the crap is a sort of a subtle recognition of the fact that it's gone a little bit too far. But I mean, it's not the first time that this sort of thing has happened. I mean, governments are always talking about cutting the red tape, aren't they? And, you know, there's too much delay and obfuscation and bureaucracy in Whitehall. We need to cut through this and actually get stuff done. So we've heard it before. It's just that, you know, this is just this government saying it rather than a previous government.
I rather knowingly chose to illustrate this story on the clampdown on consultation culture with a picture from Yes Minister of Jim Hacker when he was the Minister for Administrative Affairs, because he was put into cabinet or into was that a cabinet post? I think it was in the fictional TV sitcom of the 70s.
I was going to say it's not real life. It might sound like it, but it's not.
Very
real.
Much was, although it wasn't. Yes, it was. It's very realistic, I should say. Yeah. But he was put into cabinet to reduce red tape, and he had to keep coming up with these initiatives to cut red tape. In other words, just the more you try and cut these things back, the more bureaucracy you create yes. another department to cut departments. I mean, it's just
exactly. Yeah, this is going off on a tangent slightly, but I was speaking to a friend of mine who's a teacher at a local school, and apparently a lot of schools, academy trusts are doing, because they have a lot of autonomy, they can make up their rules and they can do things which I didn't think you were allowed to in the public sector. Like, for example, this particular friend of mine had a doctor's appointment last week, meant that she had to leave work 20 minutes early, and so then she got an email the following day from the senior management team saying, you know, because you weren't here for the full day, the full school day, and we had to cover you, we're going to dock you 20 minutes of your pay.
Blimey.
And she said that the bureaucracy involved in actually getting this sorted out probably cost more than the amount of money that she was having to. Yeah, it's just crazy. But, you know, maybe that is the public sector at work. That's just the way they operate.
Well, I'm afraid I've never had the pleasure of working for the public sector, but that's certainly my my prejudicial view of it.
But this won't be the first time a politician has stood up on a soapbox and told us that he's going to cut through the red tape and get things done.
Because, not the first and not the last.
No, absolutely not, no.
Moving on to a slight change of subject, our first fuel conversation. The another government document, government initiative, which has been talked about for years, and it, like the whole Grenfell agenda, it predates this government. It's Conservatives before them who are doing it. The Future Homes Standard. This is, you know, the
thing. Oh, yes.
New homes must all have heat pumps or similar, and solar panels. And I didn't get terribly excited about the Future Homes Standards, although apparently it was saying that the requirement for solar panels would be rather deeper than house builders think is entirely sensible or economic. So it's just another burden on house builders. All the time the government said we're the builders, not the blockers, and we're going to build 1.5 million houses. There are new regulatory burdens, new financial burdens placed on them, and costs of doing business are going up. And so every time the government does something with a view to encouraging and promoting house building, at the same time it does something to slow it down, such as is the way of government, I guess. But what I was particularly interested in was the idea that plug-in solar panels, which are not much of a thing in this country at the moment, but the government quite likes them. They have a lot of them in Germany. It says, yeah, we're going all for plug-in, so you know, plug-and-play solar panels. So you don't need a special fitter to come and a whole complicated system put into your house. You don't need to put them on your roof. You can just stick them on your patio. As I understand it, plug it into your mains and it feeds into, the solar panel feeds into your mains somehow, I don't know. But apparently it's as simple as that. And
sounds
the government
too
have been working with those fine people at Lidl. We talked about the middle of Lidl a couple of podcasts ago, one of my favourite sections of one of my favourite stores. I've also been exploring their wine rack in Lidl. I hadn't realised quite how good that was. But we'll be able to be buying solar panels in Lidl soon. And I find that quite exciting. My experience of solar products from Lidl, I've learnt not to buy, you know, those sort of glow garden lanterns that are solar powered, and other sort of garden decorative devices that are solar powered, apparently. Well, in my garden, they never last for more than a week. They're completely useless. I don't know.
So they're supposed to lead you down the garden path, aren't they? And I think in this case, that's exactly what they've done.
Yes.
Now, I think this whole idea of plug-in solar panels is intriguing. I mean, I don't know if it's the same where you live, but where I live, obviously agricultural land is being covered with solar panels now because the energy secretary seems to think that they're the best thing since sliced bread. And I've always thought, well, you shouldn't put solar panels all over prime agricultural land because that's a waste, basically. And I don't believe them when they say, oh, the sheep can still graze underneath them. I've always said, and I know that there's actually quite a big movement to promote this, which is that you should put solar panels on hospital roofs and school roofs and car parks and all these big buildings, factories and stuff like that, all these buildings with great big flat roofs, and you can stick these solar panels on. I think that makes perfect sense. I'm less convinced about people putting solar panels on their roof because they're so small. But this is even going smaller. I mean, I think they're just talking about one or two solar panels in your garden or on your shed roof or something like that.
Or on your balcony if you're in a flat.
Or on your balcony, yes. Well, I suppose that's good for people who live in tower blocks because they haven't had access to the generous handouts from the government that other people have who can put windmills and solar panels up in their garden. But I'm not sure how effective it would be, actually, because all the energy going into the national grid has to be balanced. So, you know, your wind farm and your solar farm, they go into the grid, and somebody on a computer somewhere says, well, we'll bring these on stream because we're going to need so many more megawatts in a minute. And so they have to balance it in real time. But I don't know how they do it when everybody down the street has got a solar panel pumping a few amps into their ring main. Obviously, the technology is there. They wouldn't do it otherwise. But I find it hard to get my head around, quite honestly.
A lot of people seem to think that it's not as simple as we are being led to believe. In fact, certain sort of, the Electrical Contractors Association, there's an awful lot of, they would say that, wouldn't they? Electrical yeah. Contractors Association basically say, you can't just plug it in yourself, you know. You have to get a properly qualified electrician to come and plug it in.
What?
It says, plug-in solar products are not fit for purpose within the UK safety-led electrical framework and should not be encouraged.
Oh, well, there we are.
National Federation of Roofing Contractors also terribly worried that people are going to get on their roofs on their own without engaging a member of the Federation of Roofing Contractors. But actually, it's not just, they would say that, wouldn't they? There's a consumer safety charity called Electrical Safety First, not one I've heard of, and maybe it is funded by electricity industry or electrical contractor, electricians' vested interests. So maybe there's a vested interest behind it. But if it's a genuine consumer-led thing, then let's take it as an independent viewpoint. They're saying that they recognise the potential for plug-in solar panel systems. They actually operate in a way that's not currently permitted by regulations. They say, while the risk remains low, without wiring regulation changes, and under certain conditions, plug-in solar PV systems connected to standard household sockets can cause overheating or impair the operation of protective devices such as RCDs in a property. Apparently the government's aware of this and they're looking at introducing these safety standards, but there are hurdles between the rollout of these plug-and-play solar panels, apparently. So although they're promising them in the middle of Lidl within the next couple of months, wait and see. I don't know.
Yeah.
I'll be tempted. I'll be tempted to buy one, I have to say, depending on the price, of course.
Yeah, I guess I'd put one on my shed. I wouldn't put it on the house, but I'd get somebody else to stick it up there. I wouldn't do it myself. But, I mean, do you get, you know, you get these feed-in tariffs if you've got a field, like a lot of farmers have here. Well, all farmers have fields, but you know what I mean. You've got a corner of a field where you stick a few panels and you get the feed-in tariff and you get paid for contributing to the national grid. Are they suggesting that people who buy these little panels will get paid by the power suppliers for actually contributing to the amount of electricity in the system?
I don't know that they've gone that far. I think you can reduce your bills. I think you'll pay less because when you're consuming electricity, some of it will be from the solar panel rather than from the electricity company.
I mean, you've got to get something back for it, haven't you? Because I mean, if you're contributing even a tiny amount of electricity to the national grid, you're not doing it for the goodness of everybody else. You're doing it because
to reduce your own bills.
You've bought the panel, you want to get the benefit from it.
What you're suggesting, which sounds absolutely what the government's suggesting, that if I have a big enough garden with enough sunshine and buy enough of these things and have an adapter plug with
massive multi-socket,
I could end up making money. Yes, being paid a little mini private solar farm.
There's something nice about this and something a little bit worrying. And the nice thing about it is that it's a sort of like, it's a bit like citizen journalism, which of course I don't agree with, but you know, where people, everybody can contribute, everybody has a say, everybody can do their little bit and contribute to the dialogue and in this case contribute to our energy production, which is nice. It's good. It's probably good to think that, you know, you're just making a tiny contribution, but you know, like your vote, it can still count. But there's also something of the fact that it means that any any Tom, Dick or Harry can plug a panel into a socket, and as you've just quoted, maybe with some really scary wiring, you know, start a fire or do something, and if we become dependent upon millions of people contributing a few volts per day to the network, what happens if it all goes awry and people either lose interest or their stuff stops working and they don't bother with it anymore, and then we lose that amount of energy coming in and we've got to do something else instead? It all seems a little bit flaky to me.
I see a bigger, not necessarily bigger, another problem. When I buy my solar panel from the middle of Lidl, discover that it doesn't do me any good whatsoever because there's no sunshine in my garden, or because it runs out of steam, and you know, rather like my little solar powered glow lamps don't work after a week. and it turns out to be rubbish, I'll be taking it down to the local dump and queuing up behind lots of everyone else with their middle of little solar panels. And it's a recycling nightmare, which we've already talked about with solar panels, the recycling issue, the waste stream. We've talked about this before. What is the life expectancy of even a good solar panel? It's only 10 years or something, isn't it?
Well, I don't know. I think they've come on an awful lot. In my back of my mind, 10 years, yes, is what I've heard. That, you know, basically they don't work particularly well. They become inefficient, or they just pack up after about 10 years. And then, of course, you've got to recycle them. And I think that is a problem which a lot of people often don't really consider.
I'm just Googling. Sorry, Dave, I'm just Googling.
Okay.
Typically 25 to 30 years.
Oh, all right, then things have got better. But even so, that means that you've got to have some way of recycling this material. And I don't know whether you can just turn them into new solar panels, or whether you've got to actually completely dismantle them and just use the raw materials for something else, or send them to landfill, which of course would be the worst possible scenario.
Send them back to China, where they came from.
Well, yeah, exactly. Or Germany, aren't they German, the little ones? Probably not.
I think they were probably via Germany, with a German badge on it for a 20% markup.
But I mean, this is an old argument against renewables, isn't it? That, you know, it costs so many tons of CO2 to actually manufacture a wind turbine, and, you know, you've got to make the turbine blades out of some sort of plastic and glass, and then at the end of the life you've got to recycle it. I don't know whether or not they've managed to square that particular circle. I suspect that they must have done, otherwise people would have been screaming about it by now. But it is a consideration, and I think you're quite right to point out, if you're talking about sort of consumer contributions to the national grid using supermarket bought solar panels that plug into your main supply, there is definitely a recycling issue there. And I don't know how it'd be far more difficult to address that than it would with your big solar farms and your big wind farms. When they do appear in Lidl, I'll check them out and see how much they cost. We'll see what we can do.
Have to do a quick cost benefit calculation, work out while you're sitting there, standing there in the middle of the supermarket. Hang on, how long will it take me to pay back this outlay on the solar panel? Is it worth it all? Or should I buy two at the same time? I don't even know what size they're going to be, whether they're going to be, you know, the size of a hardback book or a laptop, or the size of a, you know, 40-inch TV, widescreen TV or something.
Good question. Probably the latter, I would have thought. There's not much point, you know, using an A4 size solar panel. You won't get much out of that.
No, I think you probably will.
Most people have got as you say, You could dangle a big one over a balcony, or you could stick it on a shed roof, or in your garden, or on your wall, wherever.
Something that can just fit in the back of a car, that should be the size of it.
Yes, that exactly. There's another energy story which came in last week, which is quite interesting, because in the past, if we've got any regular listeners left, they'll remember that we've spoken about HVO, hydrotreated vegetable oil.
More than once.
Because more than once. It was very much a lively topic, actually, a couple of years ago, because people had been, there was the question of, I think, I can't remember when they phased it out, red diesel was no longer available to construction users, people in the plant industry. When was that? Was that 2023, 2022? I've got a feeling it's 2022. But anyway, red diesel, no longer available. Meaning that people didn't get the tax breaks from using that, and they had to use white diesel. And I thought it was quite interesting. A lot of people at the time, instead of just going back to traditional white diesel, said, well, if we've got to pay through the nose for our diesel, we might as well get the green stuff. And so they started using HVO, hydrotreated vegetable oil, a renewable diesel substitute.
Which is taxed at the same rate, because it's still diesel, and therefore it's still got the same tax as the
exactly. And in fact, I think it was slightly more expensive than ordinary white diesel. But they got the kudos from using stuff which was ostensibly renewable, and so that was really flavour of the month for several months. And then along came Balfour Beatty was the first contractor, but I think also the Environment Agency raised questions about the viability of HVO, because it's supposed to be made from waste cooking oil, basically from food production, takeaways, anywhere that will collect and recycle used vegetable oil.
You would expect to have seen, if every takeaway shop, restaurant, whatever, chippy, are selling on their, or even giving away their waste oil for secondary industrial purposes, you'd have thought you'd see these branded trucks driving around, you know, collecting it.
I've never seen it.
No one's making a song and dance saying, you know, give us your oil, we'll come and pick it up.
People were picking it up because a lot of the big fuel companies like Certis Energy and Crown Oil and people like that, they were and still are selling HVO. And of course, it slightly went out of fashion because people like Balfour Beatty and the Environment Agency were worried about the fact that used cooking oil, used vegetable oil, is a finite resource and is unlikely to increase. Well, not that it's a finite resource. I suppose it is a finite resource, although it's constantly going to be available. The thing is that demand will outstrip supply, and that was already leading to places in Indonesia and other parts of the world mass deforestation in order to plant oil palms so that they could get palm oil and turn that into HVO. And of course, that isn't green. That's deforestation. We can't have that. So HVO came under a bit of a cloud. Cutting to the chase, last week, JCB sent out a press release, which was quite interesting. It was headlined, JCB leads the way with new renewable excavator fuel option. I'll just read you a little bit of the press release. It says it's leading the way by approving 100% renewable biodiesel fuel for use in a range of X-series tracked excavators. So these are big machines. The company is set to become the first in the industry to deploy the use of B100 biodiesel in tracked excavators, told in Europe. The fuel, and this is my favourite bit, which is also known as fatty acid methyl ester, which sounds like some sort of cabaret name, doesn't it? Fatty acid methyl ester.
You think you've seen it on stage, do you? Sure.
Yeah.
Might be two people, yeah. Fatty acid and methyl ester.
It's derived entirely from renewable biological sources, and it can be used in newly manufactured JCB. Anyway, list the machines that can use it from June 2026. It contains no fossil diesel and is made from recycled vegetable oils, which brings us back to HVO. At least I said it. I thought it brought us back to HVO. So I was really curious, you know, what is the difference between B100 biodiesel, FAME, and HVO? Yeah, exactly. And HVO. And so I asked JCB to explain, which they did, up to a point, because I had supplementary questions which they haven't responded to. But basically, B100, I think this is what it boils down to, is a completely different process. It might still use the same source material, sort of recycled vegetable oil, but it's a different method. It's not hydro-treated like HVO. I can't remember what they do with it, but it's slightly different.
And there's a word that comes in called transesterification or something. I'll try that one more time. Transesterification.
Transesterification. Yeah.
No idea what that is.
No, I think you've got to be a chemist to understand what that is. But I think what it boils down to is that actually B100 is slightly cheaper than HVO. And I think this is an interesting sort of step forward beyond the HVO controversy, because HVO is one of the great benefits of HVO, which a lot of people have quoted, is that it's a direct drop-in substitute for white diesel. So you don't have to do anything to your diesel engine in order to use HVO. If you're using stuff that came out of a BP pump yesterday and you run that dry, you can just put HVO in there and carry on. It's no different. B100, though, is slightly different. It requires, and I don't know, the technicalities are probably beyond me, but it does actually require some modification to your engine. It can't just burn B100. The other thing is that B100 has certain disadvantages that HVO doesn't. Like it tends to solidify in low temperatures, which I think is a real problem if you're going to be using it in the winter. Especially if you're going to be using it in the winter in Scandinavia or somewhere like that. Presumably, you'll have to have some sort of electric heater to keep the stuff fluid. I think it's slightly hygroscopic, which means that it attracts water. So water will actually gather in the tank. And of course, the water will probably drop to the bottom of the tank and the fuel will float on top. And you've got corrosion issues there, or potentially corrosion issues. And of course, combustion issues if the water gets into the engine as well.
I know some fleet owners are not particularly excited about HVO either, as much as it, you know, earns them green brownie points for some clients and potential clients. Some people I've spoken to said, not worth it. The risk to the engine, because it's a bit scuzzy and the sort of stuff in it, it's not
pure. You get a build-up of,
And the cleaning out of the engine, the extra work that's needed to be done on cleaning out the engine, they say, I don't know if they're right or not, but they know much more than I do, they say, I'm not going to bother with that. Happy with, even though I don't have red diesel anymore, I'm just going to use regular white diesel.
The message, though, coming from JCB, as I understand it, is basically that this stuff is green. It's as green as HVO. You know, it's presumably being made from recycled vegetable oil. It still has the problem of demand and supply. But if you were to make a direct comparison between B100, this FAME stuff, and HVO, I think probably the benefits are it's cheaper. I think that's basically what it is. That's what it comes down to.
Yes.
I mean, the JCB say they've released this press release in sort of partnership. They the stuff is being supplied by a supplier called Syntec Biofuel. And they've worked with JCB to be able to use this fuel in their excavators. And they say, we've conducted extensive test and validation programs in conjunction with Syntec Biofuel. To allow X-Series excavators to be operated with Syntec ASB B100 fuel. It's compliant with all the relevant British and European standards, certified under the International Sustainability and Carbon Certification Standard, and JCB will provide full warranty cover for compliant B100 fuel when machines are specified with a B100 pack and supported by a JCB dealer B100 enhanced service contract. So basically they can say, you know, here's the machine, we've tested it, it's all tuned up to use this B100 stuff, and you can go away and you can use this cheap biofuel, and you won't destroy the planet. So I think that's the thing. It's a more affordable renewable option for people who want to tick that particular low carbon box.
But we've talked before about the HVO suppliers insist, and they've got all the paperwork to show that it's not virgin palm oil. It is definitely old chip fat that they're selling, and they're not responsible for the deforestation in Malaysia or wherever, and the extinction of particular types of primates or whatever bad stuff is happening. And that it's all good, because here's our certificate. If we've learnt nothing else from 9 years of investigations into the Grenfell Tower fire, it's that certificates are not necessarily the proof that we may think they are. I wouldn't be a least bit surprised if in 10 years' time it all comes out that, actually, these certificates don't necessarily mean what we thought they did. I am hugely suspicious of whether there is no virgin palm oil in the HVO supply chain. I bet there's at least some in there.
Oh, there's bound to be. I should read out the response I got from JCB when I asked them about this. They say B100 has been requested by customers working on infrastructure projects where fossil diesel is prohibited and HVO has been ruled out due to environmental concerns. Such as the use of palm oil. The feedstock for B100 is typically sourced from byproducts of the food processing industry, making it more environmentally friendly and fully traceable to sustainable sources. To which I responded, does it mean that B100 is subject to some kind of certification system with a traceable chain of custody, whereas HVO isn't? HVO suppliers have told us they it is traceable. And I said, surely there's only a benefit to B100 if consumers have some way of ensuring that it's greener than HVO. And JCB has referred me to Syntec for that. I mean, fair enough.
Yeah, Syntec, they're the oil company, Syntec, aren't they? Not the machine.
Yeah, I haven't followed through with Syntec, I'm afraid. So we don't know. But I mean, watch this space. I'll see what I can find out from them. We might be able to answer that question.
Everything has a trade-off. Be interested to know what.
Yeah.
how they all work out. Right, any other business? Because I think I need to be somewhere, David, right now. I've left my dog at the laundrette.
I hope it folds your clothes properly then.
No, it's been made all beautiful. We did have an idea of talking about steel tariffs, more unforeseen yes. consequences. The government, you know, trying to save the steel industry, and it's going to make it even more expensive to build things. That's going to hit tower block costs again. But we're not going to talk about that. Anything that you want to mention that we don't want to talk about?
No, I think we've covered everything. There'll be plenty to talk about in a couple of weeks' time, I'm sure.
This is our 199th podcast, David, that you and I have done.
Okay.
Let's see if we can't find something big to announce on episode 200. But from David and I for another episode of Reconstruction, we'll be back with you soon. So thank you very much. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Thank you for listening to Reconstruction, the podcast from the Construction Index. To keep up to date with the latest construction news and headlines, please visit theconstructionindex.co.uk and sign up for our free daily email news briefing.